If we want to be honest about moral universalism, sure, it's a great idea. Everybody should have human dignity. But then why is it so easy for the people that author those ideas to violate? Why is it so easy for certain states to erase whole groups of people that exist?
You're saying because these guys fell short of certain ideals, therefore the whole project is infected. Because you are a sinner and you fail does not mean that the whole thing is nonsense. You are always on a path upwards.
But what happens when certain people can't go upward with you?
I wanted to ask Alan about something you said earlier, which is sort of better and worse ways to prefer people. Most people think that having a preference for your own children might be excusable, but you gave as an example of a bad reason to prefer someone or favor someone, national borders, or land borders is what you said, and that sounds sensible, but then there is this question of to what extent does that just remove the ability to conceive of a nation? If a nation is not just a literal landmass, but interaction of people within it, if some kind of favorability for people within that landmass is arbitrary or wrong, where do we get the nation? And if we can't, would that explain why we have this rise in people who are more attracted to nationalism again as a response?
Okay, so we're never supposed to mention taxi drivers, and the example of taxi drivers is just always, you know, it's a low point. But let's just go to the taxi driver, because we often, you know, it can be useful for something. So there I was, a week ago, I knew this debate was coming up. I'm riding in a taxi from City Airport or somewhere. Anyway, white taxi driver, middle-aged man, you can imagine what's going to ensue. I mean, essentially, the argument, if we're going to be really generous, his argument was, it's too hard. Moral universalism is too hard. So like, I would like this. I know in my heart that I am a Kantian. I mean, he wasn't saying it, but in my heart, I'm a Kantian. But it's too hard. And let me tell you some reasons why it's too hard. And he started going through some reasons. My daughter, she's in a class. Every other girl is, you know, in a hijab. The neighbors, their cooking smells very different. It's a reason, right? But don't get me wrong. I am a Kantian. He didn't say it, but you know, I am a Kantian, but I'm under pressure, and I need you to realize. So in that ride between City and Hoban, there was an articulation of a lot of these themes of like, we a layer of lip service paid to a kind of universalism and an embarrassed but nevertheless defiant critique. I do have preferences, I like everyone, but those people, their cooking really does smell different. I forgive me, I need to draw a line here, and that's where I'm going to draw it. And you know, all of the history of philosophy, it was in that black cab, as it were. So this is, I'm just bringing, that's the front line. You know, this was a generous conversation. They get a lot more fraught. But these are the dividing lines in 2025. And it may just be worth bringing in my distinguished fellow panelists, onto this. If you were in the taxi, if we were all in the taxi, what would be going on? How do you read that?
That's a fine question, and I do want to hear the answer, but I also want to directly know, do you think we can make sense of the concept of a nation at all, if there isn't some sense in which you, just on principle of where someone's from or what landmass they're living in, have some kind of preferential treatment, at least from the government?
An absence of preferential treatment. In other words, a treatment for all, equal value and dignity for all.
Is it possible if there's no such preferential treatment for someone in this landmass or someone in this landmass, is it even possible to conceive of what a nation is?
I think it's essential. It's essential to have equal value and dignity for every citizen within a landmass and indeed across the world, ideally. That is absolutely something that we must have and fight for. The problem is that under certain conditions, which seem to have arisen now in the UK in 2025. This idea, which might have seemed like common sense, it was approaching common sense, you know, at a certain points in our history, even in the 20th century, it is now a seriously embattled concept. And, well, I guess we're all slightly wondering, what do we do about this? And I think this is part of what we're trying to resolve. I just wanted to bring this, as it were, up against the, you know, the real issue right now.
Yes. So, Tommy, free rein here, because you were asked some questions by Shayla, but also now by Alan. What would you have said to the taxi driver, and what do you want to say to Shayla?
Oh, God. I think I really like the taxi driver example. I can see the cycle. That's great. But I think that's the problem, right? I think this is why I think philosophy is not fit for purpose, to be honest with you. Because that requires therapy, or it requires the elimination of a certain set of biases that have been aspirationally constructed by the society, right? So, and this is the problem, right? As a philosopher, I'm able to say, I think any theory can be amended and adjusted to solve a problem. It's how you play with ideas. But as like a social scientist, as someone that's interested in facts, I'm constantly pushed back by the facts and the reality that we have before us. And the cab driver is that real reference point, so to speak. So given that there are biases, the biases are not individual failings. This is what I'm trying to communicate. Individual biases are not failings of rationality necessarily. They can fit within the aspiration that society has for its own well-being. So take America, for instance. Trump is winning because there are people in the society that are individually racist and sexist and classist, etc., but they aspire for a world that mirrors their beliefs. So they define the good as their racism, their misogyny, their bias, etc., and they have power now to make that a reality, to make their version of what we called gross, disgusting, immoral, etc., moral. Given that problem, right, that we see in the taxi driver then reflects what he thinks can be the reality, namely that other people feel that way, that his government feels that way, that his children will feel that way about people's smells and cooking, etc. Kant doesn't solve that problem.
Who said
so? So when we say, for instance, well, you know, we have this, I refuse to accept that philosophy can't incorporate black people as human beings, right? Or that we're talking and laughing, exchanging. That's interesting, because the people historically who are black that interacted with Kant, William H. Ferris considered himself a black Kantian, right? You have people like Africanus Horton, who was at Edinburgh, engaging with the idealist tradition and the nonsense that Dougal Stewart was teaching around that time. All those people said, well, despite the fact that I can read, despite the fact that I can do philosophy, despite the fact that I'm a Christian, the world still doesn't see me as a human being. It still practices slavery. It still practices colonialism. I have repeatedly said on these platforms, the errors of moral and ethical judgment among European philosophers are not mistakes. They are the manifestations of how philosophy has built into it a very specific audience. You don't make the same mistake for thousands of years and then say, oops, my bad, in the 21st century on a panel. That's not what's happened. So we've constructed history and the notions around humanity to fit very particular groups of people. And I don't think philosophy can repair that. Conversations and dialogue do not change the contours of history and knowledge. It doesn't change who owns certain segments of countries and whether or not all the philosophers who are overwhelmingly white throughout the world, who were actually the descendants of colonizers, still view people that they've colonized differently. And all I'm saying is that if we want to be honest about moral universalism, sure, it's a great idea. Everybody should have human dignity. But then why is it so easy for the people that author those ideas to violate it? Why is it so easy for certain states to erase whole groups of people that exist? Moral universalism does nothing for us but play into our affectivity about rhetorical tropes that make us feel like we're good human beings. Because the reality of the situation is that Kant himself, idealism itself, democracy itself, etc., have been used to wipe out whole populations. And that's the human tragedy that we need to think about when we're talking about morality.
But Tommy, can't we go back to this notion? Please, can't we come back to this notion of an ideal? In other words, you're saying because these guys fell short of certain ideals, therefore throw the whole thing, or therefore the whole project is infected. Can't we allow, and this is the Christian notion.
Yeah, I was about to, yeah.
Because you are a sinner and you fail does not mean that the whole thing is nonsense. You are always on a path upwards, and you should be, we should expect distinguished philosophers to have skeletons in the closet, to fail, etc.
Yes.
That's not a sign that they can't be, that they must be forever discounted. Because, you know, your approach is slightly, you know, gotcha. It's like, you know, look, Kant, blah, 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 and so therefore, but if you look at a Christian point of view, it's like, well, of course Kant failed. Of course he was saying one thing and doing another. That's what humans do. But with a sufficient, you know, looked at under kind of Christian eyes of love, it's like that doesn't block, you know, they're still climbing upwards.
That's fair. That's fair. And I'm sympathetic to that. But what happens when certain people can't go upward with you? So my question isn't that Kant made a mistake. Right. My issues and my research is largely about how certain ideas have been animated throughout European modernity, right? Zygmunt Bauman makes the same argument, for instance, about the Holocaust, right? Mm. What happens when those ideas were taken up and oops, I made a mistake and killed a whole race of people? And now those people no longer have the dignity or the opportunity to improve because I've eliminated them from the scheme and playing field of history. Do I come away with the same judgment? And that's the position that I'm coming from. Not the question of whether or not Kant was racist or Dougal Stewart was racist. We know that. That's not debatable. The question is, what of the cost of the ideal that did not imagine them on the human platform at all?
Then I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, but I mean, my answer to that is that the cost of that, that the conception of that ideal itself gets expanded in the course of human history and human encounter. I mean, you gave the names of a bunch of, of philosophers who, you know, couldn't call themselves Kantians. Look at Du Bois, who studied with Hegel. Look at what he learned. Or look at the dialogue that he created with Hegel. I mean, I would say, but I don't want to move away from the question of migration, nationalism, and so on. After all, this is part of my research. But as a methodological point of view, I'm personally more interested in those thinkers who create and show the possibility of conversation and dialogue. I mean, I think that our approaches, you know, to the appropriation of philosophy, the history of philosophy, in that sense, are very different. And I'm not sure that they can be just arbitrated in this context. But I want to say one thing about the question of migration and refugees, which is the political context, of course, on all our minds. I mean, look at what happened in London a week ago with 150,000 people out on the streets, or look at what's happening in the United States every day with ICE raids against Latin-looking people, Hispanic-looking people, dark-skinned people. It's really unbelievable. But I don't think that moral universalism has anything to do with that. I don't think our question is the pertinent question. I'm going to bring back Marx here. Okay, what is happening right now with the refugee question, migration question, isn't just a problem of moral universalism. Yes, states who are signatories to the 51 Refugee Convention, including the UK, most European nations, even the United States, who violates it every morning, have certain obligations. But what is happening is that we have come to a certain end of this anarchic neoliberal globalization. And there has been also a certain kind of appropriation of land and resources and minerals, etc. And there is climate change, there is desertification, there's a lot that is contributing to the increase in the number of global migration expansion. There is, of course, in Europe, war, Ukrainian refugees as obligations, and there is war in the Middle East. You know, is there another Nakba? There is another genocide, and I'm Jewish, and I should be saying that out loud. Where are the Palestinian refugees going to go? These are obligations. So I think that it's not just morality that has created this situation. It's the changing economic coordinates. It's the continuing conflict and states of war. And these are where our obligations are coming from, not because one subscribed to a universal morality or, you know, or whatever.
I'm interested in asking you both what I asked Alan a moment ago, because even if, as we've sort of got it written here about moral universalism, maybe not being responsible for, but contributing towards the rise of nationalism and populism, and I suppose the only synthesis I can think of to put that into a question is this idea that by developing the idea that everybody, no matter who they are or where they come from, should be treated with the same level of preference, you essentially remove the ability to have a national identity, because what else could it consist in? And that's the kind of thing which is motivating people to go out onto the streets and say, we want to bring that back. Do you think there's any truth in that? And if there's not, how can we conceive of national identity without this need to prefer certain people over others, essentially? Tommy?
Well, I mean, that's a great question, one that's debatable. You know, look, in the work that I do, I study how nations form largely from post-colonial epochs, right? So when you look at how certain groups of people were formerly slaves and then trying to be incorporated into Europe or the United States, what does that mean? What is it? What's the consequences for nations? And I don't see a way out of it. And what I mean by that is there is always a preference for the in-group. You see that in social psychology. You see that in evolutionary psychology. You see that in sociology. I don't know what to tell you. Like, human beings suck in the terms that we were created as a species, you know, and people have different arguments for it. So I do not believe that we can separate moral universalism and, as I've tried to point out, how we construct the good and the moral within a particular society from how people designate who are the good people capable of living in that society. We like to say that everyone should have human dignity, but in the real world, that doesn't work. And what's more important about that is that the people that we think deserve human dignity seem to keep making systems that say they should be protected from people that threaten what they call their human dignity. So we have a real problem of people seeing outsiders as dangers and threats to their ways of life. It is an unfortunate reality. But given that we are in the midst of war and that we are in the midst of people reasserting ethno-nationalism as the basis of state identity, I don't think that moral universalism has a persuasive argument against that. Right. So even when we admit that the world is terrible and that there's violence and war and ongoing genocide, it is not the idea, as shiny as it may be, that stops that problem. Because we have built systems like capitalism, like imperialism, et cetera, to exploit people. And the people that we have found able to be exploited are the same people that tend to die a lot in these wars, in these conflicts, in these kinds of social problems. So I don't think there's a solution. And to be honest with you, humans have always resisted, right? Humans will find new values that they're going to assert, new identities, new kinships, et cetera, to fight back, or they disappear. But what I think we have to worry about, being philosophers talking about this right now, is how our standpoint doesn't necessarily respect the dignity of all the lives of the people who are lost. Because what we risk doing is having conversations that don't anticipate their existence. That's a real problem, right? When we talk about issues of racism in America, when we talk about what's going on with Gaza, when we talk about the Ukraine war, the problem is that we don't know how to arrest the violence that our rights and our values said shouldn't be happening in the first place. And I think that as thinkers and philosophers, we have to kind of take stock of that failure rather than trying to necessarily reinvent systems that are ineffective.
Well, I wanted to give Alan a chance to just basically have free reign to respond to anything. You seemed like you wanted to say something a second ago. Some closing remarks, a response, whatever you like, and then...
Yes, I mean, I just wanted to counter Tommy's pessimism. You know, you say always a preference for the in-group. I get it, but I think if you look at history, there are more or less acute periods. I think we can accept that.
Sure.
So always preference for the in-group, and then there are very dark moments and less dark moments. Mm. So we want to try and identify what moments is the preference for the in-group, and what moments does it become murderous, at what moments does it become, you know, tyrannical, etc. Mm-hmm. And we want to try and get it from the tyrannical to the bearable. Mm-hmm. That would be success enough.
Okay.
To continue watching this video, click the link in the top left or in the description below.
With a free trial, you can enjoy the full talk and thousands more.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.